court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Gas Exploration versus Fluor.
May it please the court, Mr. Peter Sarton will present argument for petitioner. Mr. Sarton has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, before I start, I'm pleased to present to the court Mr. Frank Perry, my partner, at the table with me today. This case involves the application of statutes of repose to a cause of action that accrued even before the statutes were passed.
How did your cause of action accrue before you knew you had suffered damages? Fire didn't occur until, what, 84?
That's correct.
And you had no cause of action until the fire occurred, did you?
We had a cause of action when the facility was delivered with faults in its installation and with negligent design at the time of delivery of the facility.
1961?
Yes, Your Honor.
What and damages did you have in 1961 that you could have sued somebody for?
We had a crack in a threaded pipe joint beneath a V501 absorber.
And you could have sued somebody, and if you'd known about that crack, you could have sued somebody in 1961.
Yes, Your Honor. That...
Well, how could you determine at the time of the explosion that the crack was there in 61?
This is a summary judgment review, and the testimony of the expert was that in the... that he relied upon the examination, the documents, the pipe itself, the metallurgical analysis, the micro photography from the examination of the metallurgist, and it was his opinion that the crack occurred at that time, that it continued uninterrupted and proximately caused the resulting fire when the remaining pipe wall thickness was insufficient to withstand the operating pressures.
If for some reason you had known about this crack in 1961, would limitations have run in 1963 or 5 so that when this fire occurred, you would have no cause of action?
Yes. If I may continue with...
So if we see any little defects around our house, we better quickly sue on them before they leave.
The purpose of limitations is to establish a period of time wherein a person who has been injured, who knows of it, must pursue his rights or lose them.
Now, how come the discovery rule applies to this matter anyway?
The discovery rule applies because it is an action in negligence, because it's an action in breach of contract where the injury was unknown. Both of the statutory limitations provisions in the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code use the same non-defined accrual language. So many years from the date of accrual, and that has been judicially grafted onto with the discovery rule.
Well, now, the discovery rule, I thought, in the medical malpractice decision that you quote in your brief, it was limited to medical malpractice cases. Was it not the Sponge case and such?
That's the discovery rule as it applies to the open courts provision, I believe. The discovery rule allows the open courts, allows a repose statute to be constitutional when a person has knowledge of and is able to act on a known injury. Without the discovery rule grafted onto the open courts provision, limitations provisions would be defective in more cases. The medical providers limitation statutes are only defective when applied to specific facts, and those facts are unknown and unknowable absolute deprivation of access into the courts, no legislative substitute, no alternative remedy, meaning there's some other defendant who doesn't enjoy the benefit of the statute. That discovery rule is different from the discovery rule that Mr. Ferraro argues as far as an accrual. This court has many cases that say that actual accrual is the language of a number of cases. Actual accrual occurs at the time of legal injury. If we could have, had we known, brought suit in 1961 on the crack resulting from the faulty installation and the negligent design, if we could have brought suit then, we can bring suit now, but for the lack of knowledge. That legal damage in 1961 continued uninterrupted, progressed, approximately resulted in the damages. There is cases that say that for purposes of statutes of limitation, the discovery rule defers accrual. I'm trying to think of the precise language, that it, for purposes of statute of limitations, there isn't an actual accrual. There's an accrual that's deferred until you discover it. And Mr. Ferraro argues that because of that language, there was never an actual accrual here, and therefore the limitations period can't, the repose limitations can cut off this right to bring an action in the future.
Well, in 1961, when you had cracked pipe, the only lawsuit that you could have filed, had you learned about it, had been a suit for cracked pipe.
Yes, right? To take out the pipe, the physical injury to do so in the downtime, whatever time the refinery was down and loss of production.
But this suit isn't about cracked pipe.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
This is about a fire and multi-million dollar consequences of a fire, isn't it? Or, I mean, is that a fair distinction to draw?
This suit is about the cause of action that accrued when the facility was delivered in breach of the express warranty that would be free from faults and defects. It's about that cause of action. If there was $7,500 damage by the crack and some thousands for the downtime for 2-3 days to shut the refinery down to fix it, that's the same cause of action. Act causes net injury that occurs initially is necessarily less. The fact that the injury increases doesn't make it a different cause of action. It doesn't make our rights to bring a cause of action, once it's known, any less. There's only one cause of action. Our right of access to the court for redress of it is for that cause of action and all that proximately results therefrom.
Assuming your cause of action did accrue upon delivery of the plan, why doesn't the repose period begin to run in 1969 and expire in 1970?
The repose statute should not even be applied to an accrued cause of action.
Why not?
Because this court properly defined it in Johnson versus City of Fort Worth as a statute that applies to causes of actions that have not yet accrued. If it's accrued, you look to the limitations period. If it hasn't accrued, the purpose of the limitations of repose statute is if there has been negligence and a long time goes by and something hasn't happened because of that negligence, it will cut off the right to bring in the future a claim if in the future you're ever injured. Once there's, in this case, there was negligence, there was duty, breach, proximate cause, and damages, all occurring before the repose statute was even passed. You don't apply a repose statute when there's been an accrual. you apply the statutes of limitations. So there are four non-constitutional grounds that Texas Gas asked that its petition be sustained on and it be allowed to go seek remedy for its damages. I will use up some of my rebuttal time if I may. The first is simply that neither statute was intended to be applied retroactively, simply because they're silent on the subject. The second non-constitutional ground is this is a review of a summary judgment. A summary judgment in which the petition says the injury made this the basis of this suit progressed over a period of time from the date of delivery of the nipple to the plaintiff, which was also the date of the first load application at the startup of the system processing. That's the petition. We enjoy the presumptions. They have the burden. The only summary judgment evidence in the case was ours. The pleading in the petition comes from the summary judgment evidence. It's the opinion of the expert that that's when the crack occurred. There has been no trial on that, and we're entitled to that. The third non-constitutional ground is simply, as I referred to in response to Justice Heck's question, this, when there's an accrued cause of action, you don't apply the statute of repose. It wasn't intended to address an accrual situation. It's intended to cut off the right to bring a claim in the future if there has been no accrual. When there's accrual, it's not applicable. The fourth ground is simply that, and this is really a part of the legislative intent argument here, is that the statute itself, 1609E2, itself provides that the repose statute is accepted for suits. There is an exception for suits against one in control of the property when the injury occurs. The facts of this case, and this summary judgment review, is that the injury occurred when the defendant, builder, designer, was in control of the facility. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
May it please the court, Mr. Peter Ferraro and Mr. James Sylvester will present argument for respondent. Mr. Ferraro will open.
There are two points I really want to make. The first is a threshold point. I think the very first question from this court hit it. And that is, what are we doing here? There is no point of error that deals with the lower court's determinations that this cause of action, this injury, happened not when there was a microscopic fatigue stress crack. It's not just a crack. It's a microscopic fatigue stress crack in the affidavit.
It should have been there.
That what?
It should not have been there as per your warrant.
No, I think what they're saying in the affidavit, and I'll read the affidavit with you, but that crack occurred, they're claiming, because, I think you have to understand the facts. V501 absorber, like a rocket, under it, elbow, big elbow. Out of that elbow, a nipple, under that nipple, a 41-pound valve that you use to drain that. Okay? They're saying that the first vibration, the first movement of that valve initiated a fatigue stress crack. So maybe not at installation, but at operation, yes. Okay. And that's what they're saying is the injury.
You don't dispute that.
We disputed it from the beginning.
I thought you, for the purpose of summary judgment, you admitted it.
No.
The injury occurred in 1961.
We admitted, for the purposes of summary judgment, that a fatigue stress crack occurred. That is not legal injury. There's a difference. There's a big difference. And the court below and the trial court found that the legal injury in this case occurred in 1984. He relies on these cases of seepage and continuing injury, and that it happened here, and they didn't know that it was indeterminable when the injury occurred. In this case, half the state of Louisiana could determine when this injury occurred. The plant, the valve ruptured. I'll read you from, let me read a little bit from his affidavit. This is their expert's affidavit. In my opinion, the cause and origin of the fire was Fluor Corporation's defective design and installation of a pipe nipple located beneath the area of the V501 absorber, which directly resulted in injury to the nipple and its eventual failure. The injury consisted of metal stress fatigue cracking to the nipple wall. All right. The pipe ruptured, the explosion occurred, and the fire made the basis of this suit occurred on September 30th, 1984. Now,
there had been no fire had there not been no crack back in 61.
Had there not been any stress and back in 61, assuming for the purpose of the summary judgment record, yes. But the issue you're talking to me about and questioning me about deals with an issue of a finding of when the injury occurred. Now, there's no point of error. There's no general point of error. There's no general point that says summary judgment was improperly granted. All his points of error are specific, and all of them, all four of them, go to a determination that 61 was the year. He automatically assumes that 61 was the year of the injury. What he really should have been doing, and this is a threshold point, what he really should have been doing, if that's his argument, is questioning the lower court's determination that 84 was the year of the injury.
Counsel, isn't that subsumed within the points of error that he didn't have been brought forward because the statute of repose could not divest a vested cause of action unless he was complaining about the 1961 crack? Could it?
While you may argue that it's subsumed in there, it is not a point of error that we're arguing. We're not here to see his point of error should have been, when did the injury occur? The courts were wrong. He doesn't say this statute is unconstitutional. He never says it. In fact, he says the opposite. He says on a number of occasions that the constitutionality of the statute is not challenged. All I'm saying is I was injured in 61, not 84. Now, even if you skip over that, get to my second. I don't think he's met that threshold. It's just the Malooey Brothers case, 461 Southwest, 119. The judgment has to stand if it can be based on a ground not specifically challenged by the plaintiff, or there is no general assignment of error. Well, it's obvious there's no general assignment of error in this case, and there is no ground specifically challenging those lower courts' 84 opinions, that if the injury occurred in 84. And you can see how they can come to the conclusion the injury occurred in 84. It makes sense. I mean, there's a building over across the street that was built in 1867. Now, if I walk under that building, or I'm near that building, and a cornice falls off of that building, and crashes through the building, and hits a gas line in the building, and the building explodes, do I have a cause of action against, who was it? I wrote his name there. Frank Huster, he built that building in 1867. Do I have a cause of action against him? Well, under their theory, I do if when that cornice was installed, there was a molecular crack. It's a molecular injury argument. You are never going to get around that. It would completely abrogate the statute of repose. In every case, you will have an expert that says, the first molecule of injury occurred to me on the date it was built, if it's a design case, if it's a stress case of any type, make the statute of repose meaningless. With regard to cases, buildings before the year of passage. I have my second point that I really wanted to make is this is not violative of open court's provisions, even if it was applied to 61. But it's hard to make because we've got calls, do you want us to file amicus brief? Are we dealing with whether this statute of repose is constitutional or not? I don't know. Because its points of error more deal with a 61 issue. Now, summarily, retroactivity is one of his arguments, and that doesn't appear to me to apply. Its intent, and on its face, I don't think the legislature would pass a statute on an emergency basis that wasn't going to take effect for 10 years. I mean, I think it applies retroactively. I think that's obvious. Now, I don't know about the other four things he argued here, but his points of error are ex post facto law. Well, if you have an 84 injury, you don't have any ex post facto problem. If you don't have an 84 injury, the legislature, if it's a 61 injury, the legislature can always change the remedy. This is not an ex post facto law. It doesn't apply. His main point, it seems to me, on argument relative to constitutionality is the open courts issue. And that has or could have some appeal if you go back to the medical malpractice cases and you say, hey, you're taking away a right I never had a chance to bring because I couldn't discover it. When you analyze the open courts issue, though, your questions are, first, how do we analyze it? I think some of the language in Nelson v. Cruzan and those medical malpractice cases is unfortunate. I think the result may be correct, but I think when the court says, if you completely take away a right, and that's the way he interprets it, I don't know if that's really what the court meant, but when you say you completely take away a right and he has no chance and it's impossible because he can't discover it, then that's almost an automatic violation of the Texas Open Courts provision. I don't think that's the proper analysis. I think the proper analysis is that may be one way to analyze it. That's the first test. And frankly, I think he agrees with me on this issue because on Sachs, in his analysis of Sachs, he says you go to the next step, and the next step is the legislature. Did it act reasonably? When the legislature passed these, did it act reasonably? Well, you could say that it didn't act reasonably in the medical malpractice cases because we were 2 years and out. There was no discovery, and it dealt with a specific thing, solving an insurance crisis that, as Justice Kilgarlin wrote, was a test, was an experiment. And on that basis, doing away with the right may in fact be correct. But here, we're dealing with something else. This isn't a cause of action against architects that stand. This is a cause of action that deals with real property. Real property is the key. You can't sue if there's a defect based on an improvement to real property. It doesn't say you can't sue an architect. You can't sue a builder. You know, if they design an offshore oil rig and you move it around, you can sue them all you want. This doesn't protect architects. This deals with real property. And the reason it deals with real property makes ultimate sense. We have, from the beginning, had a special place for real property in our laws. And the transfer of risk, societal risk, for these kinds of injuries always went with the transfer of property, traditionally. When architects became sued, you know, the privity changed, other laws changed, architects became more subject to suit, we were going the other way. The risk wasn't going with the property. All those things that you, all the reasons why you wanted the risk to go with the property. First, you had an asset. Second, if you really like the asset, you're going to insure the thing. Third, you're going to take care of it. You're going to maintain it. Fourth, you're going to inspect it. You're going to look at it. You've got duties to other people, your neighbors, people who come on your property. Architect didn't have any control. He was gone. Now, the legislature said, well, look, you can't just let him go because he built it. He needs some responsibility. We need a reasonable period of time in which to determine if there is a defect, latent or otherwise. They said in the legislative history that I think 89.7% of the claims on real property, and defects of real property based on insurance statistics, were within the first 5 years. The original statute was going to be 8 years. They doubled it. So that was a reasonable limitation on which to base the societal risk that already transferred, that you want to have these people who own the property, who control the property, looking at it, inspecting it, improving it.
That's what made this the application here reasonable?
One of them. The fact that it was applied to real property.
Is
one
that legislative history part of the record that you submitted? I don't think it is.
I don't believe it is, and there's a reason for that, Judge, because I don't... The issue here was never the constitutionality of the statute itself.
Isn't it the constitutionality of its application in this way, in this circumstance?
I don't even know if it's in this circumstance. It's the application of its constitutionality to a molecular injury in 1961.
Well, even if it is interpreted in that fashion, don't you still need to satisfy the open, and with the challenge, don't you still need to meet the standard that was set up in Sachs and in Lucas and these other cases?
No, I think the standard goes the other way. On constitutionality, I believe they bear the burden of showing that the legislature did not act reasonably. In this case, I think there is, we know we're dealing with real property. So I think when you argue what's reasonable, you can know the history of what happened with, what has traditionally happened with real property. I don't think I have to go back and prove that, for instance, owners of real property were responsible if they had wild animals on their property to control them so they didn't hurt their neighbors. I mean, that I think it's their burden to come forward, respectfully. I have more time.
How much time is there?
There are 6 minutes.
I have 1 minute. Mr. Sylvester can take the rest. In that 1 minute, I'd like to point out that there are 44 states that have, it's really kind of a federal question. There are 44 states that have statutes of repose. 34 have held them constitutional. 10 have not. The 10 that have not have done so for a variety of reasons, but they're in the minority. South Carolina, as of the end of last year, and he cites the South Carolina case that originally held it was unconstitutional. Well, South Carolina, at the end of last year, said, no, it is constitutional. They made an amendment, and it was an equal protection argument, but their amendment held that it's okay to exclude current property owners because we want them to bear the risk. So it's not a violation of equal protection. It's an equal protection argument. Of those states, only two went off on open courts. Strange sets of facts. But the first open courts provision in any constitution was Pennsylvania. I was fortunate or unfortunate to go to law school there. And I had to deal with this. And it happened in the 1600s when this provision actually got in and then went in the state constitution when the state was formed. And just for example, this same or very similar statute was held constitutional under the open courts provision of Pennsylvania, which has done probably more analysis through the years on open courts than any other state. And it has a very similar open courts provision. Actually, it started with Magna Carta, but we brought it over here with the open courts provision of Pennsylvania. I'd like to give the rest of my time, Mr. President.
Any other questions?
May it please the court. To address the 4 points that Mr. Sarton submitted would be non-constitutional grounds upon which to reverse this case. The matter of retroactivity, of saying that this statute, retroactivity, he's saying that it cannot apply to a injury that has accrued within the repose period. It cannot apply to a cause of action that accrued in 1961. We've covered this already in that the cause of action for which he's brought suit, the cause of action for the damages to the plant and the economic loss, could have only accrued in 1984. And that this is, and that this statute, does, the application of the statute in this case, does not is not a retroactive application of the statute. With respect, he says that with review of the summary judgment that he has uncontroverted expert evidence that says that injury occurred. Well, I'll submit and acknowledge that it's uncontroverted that the expert said that there was a defect here. But the question about whether that defect arises to the level of being a legal injury so that a cause of action accrued is reserved for the courts below and for the determination of this court. In other words, there is a legal determination as to what the effect of that defect is. And we have submitted the cases in terms of Atkins versus Crossland and the El Paso Construction versus Reed case, which indicate that in a case such as this, is that where you have, for example, in El Paso Construction versus Reed, negligent performance by an engineer, there was no cause of action accrued until there was a subsequent event that happened later that gave rise to the damages for which suit is brought, and at that point the cause of action accrued. So even though the expert testimony is uncontroverted in this case, that does not foreclose this court from evaluating what the legal consequences of that are and determining that the cause of action did not accrue until the subsequent event in 1984. He says that it does not apply to an accrued cause of action. In terms of what a statute of repose does, taking that from the footnote of Johnson versus Fort Worth, I think that what a statute of repose does is to just, it's simpler than that. It says that there's a specific date, a specific time in which something happens. For example, substantial completion 10 years after that, it will cut off any claims that are accrue before or after the period of that time. And I think a false distinction within the law of statutes of repose. This matter of there's an exception for suits against owners, that's a new one. We've not seen that one before. That's not been in any of the briefs or arguments below. And in fact, if anything, that's again, that one is obviated by the idea that this cause of action accrued in 1984. The purpose of that particular section is to say, well, that's in the statute as an indication by the legislature of where somebody can go to get recourse. In other words, it is a reflection of the fact that when somebody has a project, has a structure, has a building, and has had it for 10 years, that they have a duty to maintain and inspect, and the defects are going to show up in 10 years, and that you're going to expect people to take responsibility for that. We have here the building owner situation. That provision also goes to third-party liability claimants who may come on the property and be injured. In that type of situation, the legislature said, you know, basically those situations are to be covered by a premises liability case, and nothing in this statute precludes that. If that particular exception of the statute is not to relate back to the builder who happened to be the owner in possession of the premises at the time of construction, what that provision provides is a reflection of the alternative and the substitute provided by the legislature of where people can get recourse when there's a problem with an improvement to real property.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. In order to reach the result that you contend for, do we have to overrule Atkins and Crossland?
No, Your Honor. Atkins versus Crossland is absolutely good law, and Weaver, Robinson, Witt, and all the cases that came thereafter, actual accrual occurs at the time of legal injury. There can be judicially grafted onto that an exception for absence of discovery for purposes of the accrual for the statute of limitations only, not for purposes of accrual of actual accrual or the accrual for purposes of vesting of a cause of action or for purposes of accrual beginning the running of prejudgment interest. There's an interesting case relied on by Mr. Ferraro trying to take this discovery language, deferring accrual, and applying it to all accruals, and saying that in the Eastern Hills Methodist Church, Fort Worth, 1980, I believe, that and the language in there that the facility was delivered with a defective foundation in the fall of that previous year, and that was actual accrual. But the church didn't know about it. It's in the dirt, and for purposes of statute of limitations, the accrual was when the cracks in the foundation first became noticeable, which is fine. We have no objection with that. But the same court, for purposes of accrual for the commencement of the running of prejudgment interest, went back to actual accrual at the time of legal injury.
So your legal injury here occurred in 1961 or 1984?
The legal injury here occurred in 1961. That's the pleadings, that's the summary judgment proof, and the effect of Mr. Ferraro's argument, he's asking this court to sit here in review of a summary judgment and hold as a matter of law that there could have been no accrual at that time, but because of his version of the facts.
But in Atkins, the cause of action, the legal injury did not occur until the IRS assessed a penalty due to the negligent tax preparation by the accountants that
yes.
occurred much earlier. Isn't the legal injury in Atkins analogous to the fire?
No.
In your case?
No. The question in Atkins, there was no legal injury. It's the same with all negligence that doesn't result in injury. It isn't an accrual. For an accrual to occur, all the elements of the cause of action must be in place. Duty, breach, proximate cause, injury. When there's duty, breach, you can't bring a cause of action. When there's injury, there's actual accrual.
Could the statute of repose be defeated in the face of a motion for summary judgment on an expert's affidavit tracing the origin of the damages to 1867 and a minute fracture in a building material that does not manifest itself until more than 100 years later?
Not unless some court under the facts of that case is willing to say as a matter of law, we're going to make the determination that it couldn't have happened.
So now, it'll be a jury question.
It would be a jury question. Now, Mr. Ferraro's analogy was inapt because in that case, he was, I believe, if I heard it correctly, walking down the street and the cornice falls off. That person has no cause of action. That's the person the repose statute is directed towards. It's that person who, at the time of the negligent installation of the cornice, had a mere expectancy. When the cornice was negligently installed, everyone else in the world had a mere expectancy. They had no accrued cause of action. They hadn't been injured. If 10 years go by and it still hasn't manifested itself in injury, they lose. That's all the previous cases under the Architect Engineer Contractor Statute of Repose. They had mere expectancies.
Is there any architect's or engineer's case where the, under your theory, where the cause of action does not accrue at the time of the building? I mean, is there anything?
No, none of them.
There's a microscopic crack in place in 1961, but the architect or engineer to be responsible has to have done something at the time of the construction. So the effect of your argument, as I understand it, is that any building built before 1969 is simply not covered by this act.
No, it is covered as to all parties who haven't yet been injured. And if there's evidence and a petition...
If there was an explosion, if the explosion had not been on a Sunday in 1984, and a lot of people had been injured or killed, as they surely would have been at most times, would those people's causes of action have been cut off?
Yes. They would not have. The architects have the benefit for those people. There has not been an accrual. They have no right to then bring a cause of action. In 1969, upon the first of the statutes being passed, it cut off, and properly so. It was the legislative wisdom to do so. And it cut off anybody at that point who hadn't yet been injured. Now, the El Paso construction case is referred to by Mr. Sylvester is not on point because there was no injury in that case. There was mere negligence, and mere negligence with nothing more does not give rise to a cause of action except in the state of Louisiana, which is a code provision, and negligence by itself is actionable. Negligence in 49 other states is not actionable, and negligence that doesn't result in a accrued cause of action within 10 years is free. Go home, don't worry about it. That's not the facts of this case. The argument here uses the same tactic was used in the trial court and the court of appeals. They say there wasn't an accrual, and they go attack all, they give the arguments assuming there was no accrual. That's simply not the facts of this case. As to, my time has expired.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the second call. The court will take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.